So welcome at another event accompanying the exhibition Paradigm of I Want to Outrun My Shadow. And yes, I would like to introduce to you our special guest, today's special guest, Geto Gorgadze, researcher and writer, whose work is focused on, between the others, on the history of colonial science. So yes, and we are happy you are here with us.
Thank you so much for the introduction and for being here. I'm really happy that you're having me here today, and I will start with my presentation, which is called Caucasian Paradise: Atmospheric Histories of the Soviet Subtropics. And do you hear me well? Is it okay? Okay. So, maybe I will just briefly introduce my area of study. So you get a sense of what I do in my research. So my project is about the colonization of the subtropics on the Black Sea coast. So I don't really cover in my work the geographical area of Armenia and Azerbaijan, and it's important to note here, yeah, because Paradjanov kind of his identity is situated at the intersection, right, of Armenian and Georgian contexts. And in my research, I cover Georgia, and I'm also ethnically Georgian as well. I come from the region, and I have this personal affinity to the context. Yeah, and my research is focused on the construction of the tropical environment in the region. So the South Caucasus is often depicted and theorized through its lush vegetation. Plants, mainly fruits, constitute both the cultural identity of the region and the vestiges of colonial histories of resource extraction. The works of Sergei Paradjanov are no exception, as these plants, mainly the pomegranate but also the quince, that you can see in these slides, embody the region's identity within the broader context of West Asia, sharing material cultures with communities in Iran, Turkey, and the Middle East. The countries comprising the South Caucasus, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, were regarded by the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union as subtropical and suitable for cultivating and mass producing of various tropical plants through acclimatization. In my presentation, I will talk about the humid subtropics, as I've already said, of Georgia as the most classic example of tropicality within the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, with a particular emphasis on the role of climate control in the creation of the so-called Caucasian paradise. The subtropics are the area which is around the actual tropical zone, which is situated between the tropics of Cancer and the tropics of Capricorn, and you see it on this map, old map. So the subtropics are towards the north and towards the south of the tropics, and these adjacent territories. And before the late 19th century, the term subtropics was absent from the scientific lexicon, as historian Alexander Polyanichev has noted. Tropics were indiscriminately applied to both tropical and subtropical regions. However, in the early 20th century, locals such as Florida, California, Algeria, the European Riviera, it's nice, in France, and South Caucasus acquired the designation of subtropics, a shift that entailed more than mere nomenclature. The subtropics were perceived as an environment ripe for scientific and agricultural experimentation, where the real tropics could be installed. Historian Joanna Conterio, in her article on the invention of the Soviet subtropics in Sochi, now a part of Russia and historically a land of Circassian indigenous communities, observes, in Soviet culture, the subtropics were understood not to exist in nature, rather the idea of the subtropics that emerged was that of a constructed natural environment made possible through human agency, acclimatized flora, and technological intervention, a deliberate correction of the natural order. The subtropics in this view were not discovered but invented, existing at the behest of the human hand. And this was a modern landscape borrowed from foreign climes. So a little bit about the context of the region. The humid subtropics, so Armenia and Azerbaijan are, so to say, like dry subtropics. They don't have any kind of like, like humidity is not present there. And on the Black Sea coast, the areas are more humid, and that's why more of like this like actual tropical flora could be introduced there. So the humid subtropics are subtropical regions along the Black Sea coast, which now encompass the territories of Georgia and Russia in the South Caucasus. The Caucasus range, it is this one, like this mountain range, right? Serves as a natural divide between Russia and West Asia, with North and South Caucasus regions. Historically, these regions were subjected to the colonization of the Russian Empire and later incorporated into the Soviet Union. The northernmost area is the city of Sochi. It's here. And its vicinity, which was established as a Russian military outpost during the occupation and expulsion of indigenous Circassian communities, which is known as the Caucasian War, that officially ended in 1861. The indigenous Circassians refer to this event as Circassian genocide, owing to the extreme acts of violence perpetrated by the Russians, leading to the killing and displacement of 97% of the population, with some communities vanishing entirely. Only Georgia recognizes the genocide, and just a couple of days ago it was recognized by Ukraine. And the region of Abkhazia, it's towards the south, so like from here, this is Abkhazia. It's also occupied by Russia and recognized by Russia and some other states as an independent country. And it was annexed by the Russian Empire in 1810, while the southernmost region here is a tropical area of Adjara, and it was annexed by Russia as a result of the Russo-Turkish War in 1878. Georgia gained independence then from 1918 to 1921 before being occupied by the Red Army, and along with Armenia and Azerbaijan and mountainous Republic of the Northern Caucasus incorporated into the Soviet Union. So it was just a little bit about the context. While the subtropics have cooler climates than the tropics, lacking the full range of tropical flora, they nevertheless remain a part of the broader tropical world. This entails imposing on the subtropics a set of colonial and racialized tropes associated with the southern climatic zones and conditions as applied to the South Caucasus. The cultural, scientific, and political discourses of the tropics are encapsulated by the concept of tropicality, as introduced by David John Arnold. To explicate the meaning of the term tropicality, I turn to his work, which he posits as a complement to the notion of Orientalism. Yet, while the Orient is portrayed through the lens of backwardness and underdevelopment, tropicality situates the natural landscape within this matrix, imbuing the tropical realm with a sense of both deficiency and promise. So Orient is more, is like broader concept which describes the people of the East as underdeveloped, and tropicality also adds the environment into this discourse. As Arnold observes, tropicality might serve to glorify aspects of nature, but it also highlighted what were understood to be its inherent deficiencies, why it was not and never could be Europe. Similarly to their European counterparts, the Russians expressed aching sentiments regarding the backwardness of the subtropical landscape in the South Caucasus, linking it to the perceived backwardness of the local population. In 1911, the editor of the book Batumi Coast, the Russian Tropics, Anisimov, remarked, "The wild yet luxuriant environment and the inculturated nature of the local population contributed to the fact that we found no specimens of the so-called decorative flora of other countries in the region, and the native species of plants were few." Moreover, in 1912, the climatologist Leonid Sobolev described indigenous populations as lower races of humans, brutally suffering from malaria, like Hindus and N-word, extraordinarily lazy, inert, able to think and care about something only following strong external coercion. The botanist Andrei Krasnov, recognized as a leading figure in the Russian Tropics project, established a botanical garden in Batumi that same year, in 1912. And he envisioned the garden as structured around the geographic origins of the cultivated plants, encompassing regions such as Chile, New Zealand, Australia, Mexico, California, Japan, and China. And Krasnov's conception went beyond a mere botanical garden to a living ethnographic museum, where alongside the plants, he had an idea of exhibiting people from these places. And Alexander Polyanichev, he's a Ukrainian historian, argues that had this project been realized, it would have been an instantiation of the human zoos that were widespread in the early 20th century. And these examples of tropicality discourse reveal its key elements, including the theory of climate determinism, advocacy for intensified scientific scrutiny of the environments, and the perceived necessity of transforming malignant climate into a productive one. To illustrate how assumptions about temperature and climate knowledge facilitate colonialism, media scholar Nicole Starosielski proposes the concept of thermal colonization. She writes, "Climate determinism and racialized thermal knowledge were integral to colonial expansion and to white supremacy. And the thermal colonization encompassed the creation of sensations that could justify expansion, dispossession, and the settler inhabitation. The idea of a thermal environment, be it hot or cold, cast indigenous inhabitants as beholden to their surroundings, while positioning newcomers, the colonizers, as capable of managing and controlling the climate. So the settlers are kind of detached from the environment, and indigenous populations are a part of this environment. These thermal assumptions shaped the visions of the subtropical region's future with colonial powers, leveraging their ability to manipulate the environment. In multiple texts about the region, colonial administrators and scientists employed thermal metaphors and detailed descriptions of the mild, temperate climate of the subtropics, thus evoking the allure of settlement while also communicating a sense of high commercial potentiality. Ultimately, thermal perception became a primary force for structuring the colonial project, enabling the justification of dispossession and the imposition of colonial rule. And this same Andrei Krasnov wrote in 1893 in his essay titled Possible Futurity of the Nature of the Batumi Region, the air is constantly saturated with moisture and the dew, one might say, it never leaves the ground, and the vegetation is, yeah, as if in the atmosphere of an eternal greenhouse. Yeah, this is true natural greenhouse for the tropical plants of these regions, which other nations would have capitalized on long ago to have tropical products at their fingertips. And for more than a quarter of a century, the fertile land has remained untapped. So he was kind of lamenting that the Russians were not as efficient in colonization use of the region as the Europeans would be. So here I discuss the concept of natural greenhouse. So they saw the tropics as a greenhouse, which is inherently the idea that, like, greenhouse is a space where the climate could be manipulated, right? So you can just adjust climatic conditions, ventilation in the greenhouse, and they saw the subtropics as a greenhouse, kind of where they could grow the floor, like the plants. And around 50 years later, avant-garde artist Lev Bruni, after his travel to the region, published an illustrated book entitled Our Tropics, where he again described the region as a natural greenhouse. He wrote, "The old Union greenhouse. There is no such large greenhouse in all of Europe. It has no glass roof. Instead of walls, there are high mountains. They protect the tea and tuberoses from the northern wind. The air in this greenhouse is humid, the sea pebbles are hot as coals, the sun does not break through the thick varnished foliage of the magnolias, but it is also hot in the shade." And when I came across the concept of the natural greenhouse in both sources, but actually there are more, it was like an integral part of this discourse is a greenhouse. I found it intriguing and also suggestive that the outer landscape was designated as a greenhouse. It was particularly interesting to me that this concept emerged during the late 19th century to the early 20th century, given that today's climate change is fueled by the greenhouse effect, discussion of which often revolves around geoengineering. Yet upon closer inspection of the logic underlying the greenhouse as a constellation of spatial and temporal technologies, it becomes evident that its primary purpose has been to engineer climates in order to facilitate colonial extraction, as I've already said. Moreover, the greenhouse or glasshouse system encodes the notion that tropical climates can be replicated and reproduced within the confines of these enclosed spaces through the implementation of various spatial and later computational technologies. Hence, all three components of this framing, the planet, the tropical landscape, and the greenhouse, are perceived and treated as variations of such an enclosed system. And to elaborate on the underpinnings of the greenhouse metaphor in relation to the tropical landscape, I refer to the concept of intermixing developed in the work of Jill Cassett's Examination of Colonial Landscaping. Cassett pointed out that the integral procedure of the intermixing is transplantation. So it's plantation, but also like introduction of the crops into the plantation. The removal of the indigenous flora and the introduction of monocultures concealed beneath the visually diverse picturesque is an exemplification of the hybridization of these landscapes, a pivotal technology of colonization that transformed the exotic into the familiar and tamed. The same logic undergirds the greenhouse technologies, as they are purposed to create artificial conditions to replicate natural counterparts, often from the colonized territories, rendering southern nature tamed enough to be showcased year-round in colder European climates. At the same time, the tropical landscape itself served as a site for a replication of other tropical landscapes. And following this logic, the Soviet administrators responsible for the execution of the plan, Soviet Florida, saw the Black Sea tropics as a space where other tropics could be installed. And this is the illustration from the journal Ogonek magazine, the issue that was called Soviet Subtropics, and you can see on the image that they kind of dissected the map of the region into the, introduced flora. And here you can also see that they were describing the original regions of the flora and different climatic conditions there. The responsible for this project, Andrei Lezhava, wrote, tropical natives from all continents fill Florida. Numerous South American palms, Chinese and Indian citrus fruits, Chinese trees, Brazilian pineapples, Yavan sugarcane, the parks and alleys of Florida are entirely made up of Australians, Chinese, Japanese. What we associate with the concept of cultural subtropics, the European Riviera, Algeria, Florida, California, all this is clearly the work of human hands. The willing intervention of a human armed with knowledge, collecting all the best in the world flora, wrote head of the General Directorate of Subtropical Cultivation, Andrei Lezhava. In the image, I've already described this. So the idea of transplantation is that the plantation would be established through the transition of these plants into the landscape. So the greenhouse, a metaphor, can be extended to encompass the temporal dimension, emphasizing how the tropics were tropicalized in colonial imaginations and discourses. These landscapes are designed and always exist between reality and desire. It doesn't mean necessarily that this was realized. So it was a plan, and there were a lot of different plans and envisionings of the region that was desired. Yet look and to be as if it was a real tropical landscape, and it was realized at some extent, but not how they expected it to be. These landscapes are designed and always exist between reality and desire, the latter suffused with visions of transformation, profitable futures, blurring the boundary between the actual and the imagined. Catherine Yusof has also positioned colonial desire as a primary force fueling the violence of landscaping, embedded within the processes of geologically rendering territories as extractable. As Yusof writes, desire is constituted in the underground, shaped in the mine, thereby revealing its structuring force behind material rearrangements that enable extractive and genocidal mechanisms to unfold and persist. And the greenhouse is an embodiment of the desire for a standardized climate, or as Yuriko Puruhata terms it, a thermostatic desire, a desire to pose the atmosphere itself as an object of calibration, control, and engineering. In its operation, the greenhouse revealed the intertwining of soil, vegetation, and atmosphere, with the latter's role becoming the most crucial. The design of the atmosphere within these spaces was a distinct accomplishment, separate from the showcase plants. As architectural technologies advanced towards the end of the 19th century, as described by Eva Horn, the greenhouses or the glass houses were structured as thematic parks that replicated the climates of tropical lands, not only for the plants, but also for the sensational experience of this distant realms for Europeans. A significant aspect of these artificial climates was that this experience excluded the hostility and volatility of actual tropics, like different diseases, malaria, but also these unexpected fluctuations of the temperature for white people, for the Russians as well, who were not really used to these climates, which itself was a source of enjoyment. I mean, this manipulation with the atmosphere. And Horn refers to these architectures as atmotopes, or spaces that seem to be open, transparent, and airy, yet hermetically sealed from the outside air. In the Russian colonial mindset, the subtropical outer landscape was akin to a greenhouse, holding the potential to serve as a site for replicating tropical environments. It might strike one as perplexing that the Russian explorers of the tropical region employed the term greenhouse to convey their ambitions of redesigning the actual territory into a productive and picturesque landscape. Yet, when examined through the lens of a broader program aimed at expanding climate control, the greenhouse metaphor reveals its non-metaphorical implications. The thermostatic desire became a theme of Russian science fiction or climate fiction that promoted geoengineering strategies in the beginning of the 20th century. One work is specifically important for analysis of the tropical landscape, and this is the work by a rocket scientist and proponent of Russian cosmism, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, The Future of Earth and Mankind, published in 1928. Russian cosmism was a scientific, artistic, and philosophical movement that involved the doctrine of immortal life through curing death with science and technology, while claiming that outer space were the territory of both immortal life and infinite resources. In Tsiolkovsky's essay, he proposes a climate engineering program for various climate systems where the tropics are regarded as the most crucial for achieving the goal of global climate engineering, advocating for colonization and taming of these regions and their transformation into productive landscapes. And usually when we hear about Russian cosmism, it's not being described as colonial project, and people consistently deny this claim that Russian cosmism is Russian colonialism, basically. But if you take a closer look of these literary works and artistic works, you can see that they explicitly advocated for colonization. And Tsiolkovsky wrote, "I call Earth a desert. 4 hectares or 400 hours for fertile tropical soil is available per person, but even 1 hour, the foundation of a house 25 meters per side, is a lot for one individual. How is Earth not a desert if there is 400 times more soil than necessary? Only when Earth's population has increased as 1,000 times will man become master of the soil, ocean, air, weather, plants, and himself. Therefore, reason tells us that reproduction and simultaneous conquest of fertile and carefree tropical lands must be foregrounded. And this is no easy task. It will require all of humanity to mount a united struggle against nature." In his work, the tropics were framed as paradise-like, winterless climate and wonderful fertile soil, yet posing challenges to settlers, such as humidity, bacteria, insects, and animals, to which native people have adapted but are, I quote, unable to make use of the paradise bestowed on them and lead pitiful, impoverished lives. And he was regurgitating the ideas of these colonial scientists who were writing the similar statements about the actual subtropics of the Russian Empire. And he claimed that was the reason why the land should be declared a common property, allowing its relandscaping by, I also quote, a multi-million man voluntary army. Thus justifying the colonization of the tropical regions with the traditional colonial trope of civilizing and developing the indigenous land, Tsiolkovsky believed that the tropics held the key to unlocking humanity's potential for managing the planetary climate. In this work, the colonial underpinnings of geoengineering are unfolded as his infrastructural projects were envisioned as large-scale constructions that separate settlers from the environment while transforming it and allowing the expansion. In the tropics, he proposed constructing a system of mesh nets and individual cages to shield the military members or the colonizers from the climatic elements, where they would stand and eradicate the local flora, planting the prolific one, then repeating the process on another strip of land. Another one was his idea to build mirrored roof panels for tropical houses reflecting sunlight to maintain thermal comfort within, while the only heat source would enter the space through easily adjustable windows. Tsiolkovsky's essay reveals a nexus between the colonial urge to tame the tropics and the justification or even advocacy for geoengineering technologies. As with the future of planetary climate, the discourses surrounding tropicality were interwoven with anxieties about survival, but the tropics were saturated with contradictory ideas in the colonial imagination, simultaneously hostile and paradisical, repugnant and coveted, savage and promising, which on the one hand challenged the existence of empires by posing manifold impediments to expansion, while on the other promised their very prosperity. And thus I argue tropicality was not only the question of controlling the local climate, but also a step towards planetary climate engineering, pointing to its colonial underpinnings. I will just briefly discuss the broader context of the climate in engineering at that time. So just to give a sense why it's important to talk about it. So the scientific preoccupation with geoengineering in Russia can be traced back to the Soviet times, when the climatologists were actively working on the projects of modifying local climates, but also the planetary one through the dispersing sulfate into the atmosphere. And it has a connection to what's happening now, because the Russian carbon agenda is based on climate engineering, and Russians now advocate for geoengineering because they need to extract fossil fuels and sell them, and that's why they perpetually advocate for geoengineering rather than green transformation. And that can be traced also like back to the beginning of 20th century that I've described just now. And throughout the Soviet Union, they were over and over again trying to propose the program of climate engineering. And also, like in this image, you can see the project of also like avant-garde architectural project in Sochi that would kind of speak to the line of Tsiolkovsky's essay, and you can see here they also have this mirrored roofs and glass house and everything. And what was actually then constructed was also following this logic, and we all have seen, I think, this social modernist architectural architecture of these glass houses. I don't have the image now, but you know this, right? So these huge buildings, shadow devices and everything, that would allow people to travel to these regions and to have a nice time at the resorts, the beaches and stuff. I will go to the next section of my presentation. And in 1913, an exhibition titled Russian Riviera, showcasing the achievements of the empire in the subtropics, was held at the St. Petersburg Imperial Botanical Garden from October to November. And the official description of the exhibition reads, "The aim of the exhibition was to familiarize a wide audience, but especially entrepreneurs, with the natural riches of the Black Sea coast, as well as to give a comprehensive view of the resource and production of potential of the region. This exhibition could be interpreted as also like these images are also from this exhibition. And it's the glass house where they installed all the tropical flora that they were trying to cultivate in the region. This exhibition could be interpreted as a strategy to reproduce the tropical climate within the cold weather, which the greenhouse of the botanical garden would ensure, and thereby claim the success of the first steps in controlling this climate. The exhibition aimed to showcase the first results of government policy in developing the colossal economic, natural, climatic, and strategic potential of the region. It was a quote from the brochure of the exhibition. With the local climate, flora, and fauna as the central focus, it consisted of multiple sections, from the display of railroad infrastructure to the presentation of tea from the recently established plantations. Of particular interest to me was the exhibition's separate section on weather, where the Meteorological Bureau of Land Management showcased the full model weather station, complete with devices used to parallel observe atmospheric phenomena and plant growth processes. This section also featured a vitrine with 30 reversal film slides depicting different cloud formations as signs of the weather, which, I quote, attracted universal interest and was accompanied by a table of methods to determine the weather by eye without using measurement instruments. It is indicative that the captured cloud types and instructions on the weather observation were presented at the exhibition about the tropics, as they served as the result of extensive work on establishing systematized research and observation institutions in meteorology, both worldwide and in Russia, during the second half of the 19th century. And the presence of these slides of the clouds, in the exhibition, pointed out that the atmosphere can be rendered visible to an eye, not just schematized in the map, which makes it a distinct object of interest, inquiry, enjoyment, and glory, not only for the scientists, but for the state and regular visitors. I suggest that from this moment, the tropical atmosphere was advertised as a commodity alongside palm trees, tea, and tangerines. Empire of Air Ocean. In the Russian Empire, organized meteorological research started in 1830s. And the biggest occurrence in the expansion of this infrastructure and research was the publication of a climatological atlas of the Russian Empire by meteorologist Mikhail Rykachev in the year 1900, which featured 89 maps, thereby visualizing a big amount of data and providing a systematic overview of the empire's climate. The gathering and classification were gradually evolved, accompanied by a specific approach to the atmosphere. Here, its dynamics and movement came to the forefront of a science intertwined with the military and colonial interests. Through the efforts of the Aeronautics Department of the Imperial Technical Society, Rykachev also supported observation of cloud forms and movements from aerostats, to which Dmitry Mendeleev made a contribution. He is famous for creating the first accepted periodic table of the chemical elements, but he soon became interested in gas properties, particularly in the upper atmosphere. And this interest led him to investigate aviation technologies that would enable detailed measurement of meteorological data, and as he would write, the very genesis of all changes in weather. Unsurprisingly, the state eagerly supported his endeavors in aviation because, as historian Michael Gordon writes, I quote, the Russian military grew more interest in balloons in 1880s for reconnaissance, observation of the weather, and bombing. Mendeleev's main theoretical interest was focused on the gas expansion in relation to a gas elasticity. And he set out to develop a model of aerostat that could reach the required heights while also petitioning state authorities for funding, convincing them the aerostat would ensure the success of military. And I'm saying it because it's important to know that this atmospheric research and infrastructure that was established at that time was in nature a colonial project, and tropical environments were not in the center, but also a big element of this research. And the aim of controlling the tropics was involved in this whole atmospheric control idea and research as well. Not only, of course, tropics, but also the northern parts of the empire, Siberia, and other regions, like climatically dense regions, were important here. But ideologically, Mendeleev's ideas would later evolve into the notion of Eurasianism, an ideology and geopolitical conception that casts Russia as possessing a unique cultural and political path, distinct from both so-called the West and the East. And this idea exposed the creation of a distinct geopolitical entity, Eurasia, as the embodiment of the Russian civilization. And they still use this ideology as a justification of its expansionism, as if like this civilization encompasses the whole continent of Eurasia and is a part of a Russian world. At the core of this ideology lay a spatial understanding of civilization and its inherent unity, positing that Eurasia was defined by its landscape and climatic conditions. The conception of Lebensraum, as developed by the German geographer Friedrich Ratzel, was used by the Nazis, held a prominent place in this framework, in the Russian framework, I mean. In the Russian translation of his work, Lebensraum was reframed as a developmental space as opposed to the living space, suggesting that the entire continent belonged to the Russian world as a unified and natural sphere of this civilization's development, thereby obscuring the history of colonization and subjugation of these lands. The colonization of the territories by Russia represented additional challenges, leading the Eurasianists to separate subjugation from outright conquest somehow. For Mendeleev, studying the national environment of Russia was explicitly an expansionist endeavor, as his main contribution to Eurasianism was the thesis that civilization must expand eastward and southward, which he believed was necessitated by the Russians' growing population and perceived lack of land for settlement. In 1880, 7 years before his intrepid air balloon ascent, he published a work entitled On Liquids Resistance and Aeronautics, where he summarized the findings of his research on the resistance of the environment. In the introduction, he outlined a political premise for this research stemming from a shared sentiment among proponents of the Russian expansionism. Russia, though lacking in vast water oceans, commands a free air ocean. Given the rarefied nature of the upper atmosphere, it enabled aeronautic travels, which in his view provided the sole means to explore the uncharted fringes of this ocean, for the empire to bloodlessly possess. He compares his endeavor to the war, stating that ascertaining the resistance of the environment is as crucial as a war strategy. He conceptualized the empire through its airspace or air ocean, developing a territorial understanding of the atmosphere. And this approach held particular importance for military strategy as it framed the dynamics and materiality of the atmosphere in relation to potential targets, but it also weaponized the atmosphere through ancient colonial and military analogies to underline the significance of colonization of the airspace through its control. And it's important for the histories of the South Caucasus, because as I've said and I've been describing, that the product of the subtropical landscape is an atmospheric project. So the landscape and the environment of the subtropics, the territory, was understood through its atmosphere. So the atmosphere was territorialized in the region. And as I want to argue that these fruits and these plants that were attempted to be cultivated and also were cultivated because Georgia was a supplier of 95% of tea in the whole Soviet Union, so they did actually succeed in this project of installment of the tropics in the region. But I think it's interesting how these colonial ideas in the atmosphere should be controlled. Like this intangible, invisible atmosphere being territorialized is also seen through this imperial logic. And the last part of the presentation would be, I would try to like link this whole thing that I've told you about the atmosphere and climate engineering and the region, Jordan, subtropics. So in the Soviet Union, the weather manipulation research and practice gained this momentum in the 50s, coinciding with the Cold War. In the Cold War, the atmosphere was highly militarized. As historian Kristen Harper writes in her book, Make It Rain, weather control efforts underway in the Soviet Union were the real drivers of interest in the weather control in the United States. And the reason federal money was available for their work. United States meteorologists had long speculated that their Soviet counterparts were ahead in the weather control. And Georgian institutions and scientists were at the forefront of this research. A major research project on hail suppression was conducted at the Transcaucasian Hydrometeorological Institute and the Institute of Geophysics of the Georgian Academy of Sciences, leading to the establishment of the USSR's first hail suppression service in the Republic of Georgia in 1961. The hail suppression process involves dispersing substances in this case of copper acetoxylene compounds into clouds to prevent hail formation or nucleation. And the testing of these clouds seeding procedures began in the region. In the Soviet Union, it was the first one in Georgia. And it was concluded that this activity could provide valuable benefits to agriculture, prompting the Soviet government to support operational seeding program in various other locations. And this program has led to the development of the Alazani rocket, which was employed also in the beginning of the 60s. It was the USSR's first hail suppression rocket, primarily utilized for safeguarding agricultural yields in the region. Yeah, so we can see, right? So in Georgia, they were testing this technology of the weather control specifically for agricultural purposes. And I see this as a kind of like a quintessence of this coloniality of the atmospheric control, right? So the territorial logic is coming to the forefront here, that they specifically use this in Georgia, which was like the most fertile region in the Soviet Union, and it was like highly militarized program. And I have read some CIA reports from the US on this, so they were also scrutinizing this program in the Soviet Union, the way the Soviets used these rockets, while actually it was not only inter-imperial stuff, but also facilitation of extraction in the region, and also the materials that are used in these technologies are toxic. I don't have enough information now on the repercussions of the implementation of these technologies in the region, but I think it will be like a next step in my research. And now I want to show you a short scientific film from the 1972, after it was made as a propaganda piece, in my view, after the drought that was widespread in the Soviet Union that same year. And I think it's also interesting to see how the government, how the state was dealing with the atmosphere and with the atmospheric control, how they were trying to represent their prosperity and their success in controlling environments through the atmosphere. And also it's situated mostly in the Transcaucasia, just another name for the South Caucasus.
Изучая законы формирования погоды, человек ищет способы воздействия на нее. Содружество метеорологов и селекционеров позволило с большей эффективностью использовать природные условия. Появились новые плантации чая. Китайский, индийский, цейлонский чай растет теперь и в Закавказье, и под Краснодаром. Расширились посевы хлопчатника. Во многих районах страны расходят плантации риса. Благоприятные условия погоды широко используются человеком. Солнечная энергия нагревает воду. Ветер вращает крылья двигателей. Однако атмосферные явления могут нанести и немалый вред. Грозы иногда вызывают лесные пожары. Ливни смывают почву. Град губит растения. Гололед обрывает электрические провода. Весной после наступления тепла нередко вновь вторгается холодный воздух, приносящий ночные заморозки, когда гибнет урожай. Туманы затрудняют работу транспорта. Много ущерба приносит сельскому хозяйству засухи, обжигающие растения суховеи. Зная вредные особенности погоды, ученые ищут пути борьбы с ними. От пыльных бурь посевы защищают лесными полосами. Кроме того, лесные полосы задерживают снег и влагу. Растительные каналы и искусственное дождевание позволяют бороться с засухой. Задымление сада ослабляет на несколько градусов ночное охлаждение воздуха и спасает растения от заморозков. Еще больший эффект дают грелки. Растения можно защитить различными покрышками. Эти меры улучшают погодные условия в приземном слое воздуха, что помогает нашему сельскому хозяйству. Советские ученые нашли также способы борьбы с другими вредными явлениями погоды. С помощью летающих лабораторий можно рассеивать туманы, разрушать грозовые облака, искусственно вызывая выпадение дождя до того, как образуются крупные градины. Для этого нужно внести в туман или облако размельченные частички углекислоты, то есть сухого льда. Только 1 грамм сухого льда рождает 10 триллионов зародышей, а они, в свою очередь, превращают в кристалл около 5 тонн воды в облаке. Посеять сухой лед можно с помощью специальных самолетов. Можно выстрелить в грозовое облако снарядом с кристаллами углекислоты. Можно послать ракету, заряженную тем же сухим льдом. Затрачена ничтожно малая энергия, и грандиозный облачный процесс покорился человеку. Вместо града на землю пролился освежающий дождь. Однако это только первые шаги на трудном пути. Придет время, когда садам и полям не будут угрожать ни град, ни засуха, ни гроза.
Yeah, so that's the end of the film, and I guess the end of my presentation. And I just one thing that I didn't devote this much time, but I feel like it's really important to know that in Parajanov's films, we can see how these plants' histories or plants' identities are opposing to this scaled plantationist logic of the Soviet Union, right? And this also coincides with the logic of his work in the film, that he also opposes this universalizing gaze of the Soviet movies, and he kind of counteracts this scaling, this like universalizing logic, but also this violent processes of narrating culture and environments and the history of the region. Yeah, thank you so much. I hope it was interesting. Yeah. The CIA publication, you mean? Or yeah, there is the I think a couple of reports that I've discovered, like online, the CIA's intelligence of the US, right? So they, and also one American meteorologist wrote a piece which is called the Weather Control in the Soviet Union. It was written in 1976. Let me open just a second. It is by Louis Batten, and he covers like the whole endeavor of the weather control in the Soviet Union, and in particular in Georgia. Thank you. Thank you.